Chapter 18. A Chat with Suan. Daishar had been taken away when Egwene left the tent, of course, but the seven-striped stole hanging from the opening of her cowl worked better than an Aes Sedai's face at making a way through the crowd. She moved in a ripple of curtsies, with the occasional bow thrown in from a warder or a craftsman who had some task among the sisters' tents. Some novices squeaked when they saw the Amerlin's stole, and whole families stepped hurriedly off the walkway, making their deep curtsies in the mire of the street. Since she had been forced to order punishment for some of the Two Rivers women, word had spread among the novices that the Amerlin was as hard as Sorela Bagand, and it was best to avoid incurring her temper, which could spring up like wildfire. Not that most of them knew enough history to have any real idea who Sorela had been, but her name had been a byword of iron-handed strictness in the tower for 100 years, and the accepted made sure that novices absorbed tidbits like that. It was a good thing that Egwene's cowl hid her face. By the 10th time a novice family leaped out of her way like frightened hares, she was gritting her teeth so hard that seeing her face would have cemented her reputation for chewing iron and spitting nails. She had the horrible feeling that in a few 100 years, accepted would be using her name to frighten novices the way they used Sorela's now. Of course, there was the little matter of securing the White Tower first. Small irritations had to wait. She thought she could have spit nails without the iron. The crowds thinned to nothing around the Amerlin's study, which was just a peaked canvas tent with patched brown walls, despite the name. Like the hall, it was a place to be avoided unless you had business there or were summoned. No one was simply asked to the hall of the tower or the Amerlin's study. The most innocuous invitation to either was a summons, a fact that turned that simple tent into a haven. Sweeping through the entry flaps, she swung her cloak off with a feeling of relief. A pair of braziers made the tent deliciously warm after outside, and they gave off very little smoke. A touch of sweet scent lingered from the dried herbs that had been sprinkled on the glowing embers. "The way those fool girls behave, you would think I—" she began in a growl, and cut off abruptly. She was not surprised to see Suan standing beside the writing table in plain blue wool, finely cut but simple, a wide, tooled leather folder held to her chest. Most sisters still seemed to believe, like Delana, that she was reduced to instructing Egwene in protocol and running errands, grudgingly in both cases, but she was always there bright and early, which seemed to have gone unnoticed so far. Suan had been an Amerlin who chewed iron, though no one would believe who did not already know. Novices pointed her out as often as they did Lyanna, but with an air of doubt that she really was who the sisters said. Pretty, if not quite beautiful, with a delicate mouth and dark glossy hair to her shoulders, Suan looked even younger than Lyanna, only a few years older than Egwene. She could have been taken for one of the accepted without the blue-fringed shawl draped across her arms. That was why she never went without the shawl, to avoid embarrassing mistakes. Her eyes had not changed any more than her spirit, however, and they were icy blue awls aimed at the woman whose presence was a surprise. Halima was certainly welcome, yet Egwene had not expected to see her stretched out on the brightly colored cushions that were piled along one side of the tent, her head propped on one hand. Where Suan was pretty, the sort of young woman, seemingly young at least, who made men and women alike smile at her, Halima was stunning, with big green eyes in a perfect face and a full, firm bosom, the sort who made men swallow and other women frown. Not that Egwene frowned or believed the tales carried by women jealous of the way Halima attracted men just by being. She could not help the way she looked, after all. But even if her position as Delana's secretary was plainly a matter of charity by the Grey Sister, a poorly educated countrywoman, Halima formed her letters with the awkwardness of a young child, Delana usually kept her busy all day with some sort of make-work. She seldom appeared before time for bed, and then it was nearly always because she had heard Egwene had one of her heads. Nisau could do nothing with those headaches, even using the new healing, but Halima's massages worked wonders, even when the pain had Egwene whimpering. "I told her you wouldn't have time for visits this morning, Mother," Suan said sharply, still glaring at the woman on the cushions as she took Egwene's cloak with her free hand. But I might as well have played cat's cradle with myself as opened my mouth. Hanging the cloak on the rustic cloak stand, she snorted contemptuously. Maybe if I wore breeches and had a mustache, she'd pay mind. Suan seemed to believe every one of the rumors about Halima's supposed depredations among the prettier craftsmen and soldiers. Strangely, Halima seemed amused by her reputation. She might even have enjoyed it. She laughed, low and throaty, and stretched on the cushions like a cat. She did have an unfortunate liking for low-cut bodices, incredible in this weather, and she nearly came out of her blue-slashed-green silk. Silk was hardly the usual garb for a secretary, but Delana's charity ran deep, or her debt to Halima did.
"You seemed worried this morning, Mother," the green-eyed woman murmured. "And you slipped out so early for your ride, trying not to wake me. I thought you might like to talk. You wouldn't get so many headaches if you talked over your worries more. At least you know you can talk to me."
Eyeing Suan, who was peering down her nose disdainfully, Halima gave another smoky laugh.
"And you know I don't want anything from you, unlike some."
Suan snorted again and deliberately busied herself with placing the folder on the writing table just so between the stone inkwell and the sand jar. She even fiddled with the pen rest. With an effort, Egwene managed not to sigh. "Just." Halima did ask for nothing beyond a pallet in Egwene's tent, so she could be on hand when one of Egwene's headaches came on, and sleeping there must have given difficulties with carrying out her duties for Delana. Besides, Egwene liked her earthy, outspoken manner. It was very easy to talk to Halima and forget for a little while that she was the Amarlin seat, a relaxation she could not have even with Suan. She had fought too hard for recognition as Aes Sedai and Amarlin, and her grip on that recognition was too tenuous. Every slip from being Amarlin would make the next slip easier, and the next after that, until she was back to being regarded as a child at play. That made Halima a luxury to be treasured quite apart from what her fingers could do to Egwene's headaches. To her annoyance, though, every other woman in the camp appeared to share Suan's view, with the possible exception of Delana. The Grey seemed too prudish to employ a light skirt, no matter what charity she thought she owed. In any case, whether the woman chased men or even tripped them up was beside the point now. "I'm afraid I do have work, Halima," she said, tugging off her gloves. "A mountain of work, most days." There was no sign of Shiriam's reports on the table yet, of course, but she would be sending them soon, along with a few petitions she thought merited Egwene's attention. Just a few. 10 or 12 appeals for redress of grievances, with Egwene expected to pass the Amarlin's judgment on each. You could not do that without study and questions, not and hand down a just decision. "Perhaps you can have dinner with me." If she finished in time to do more than eat at her table right there in her study. It was getting on toward midday already. "We can talk then." Halima sat up abruptly, eyes flashing and full lips compressed, but her scowl vanished as quickly as it had come. A smoldering remained in her eyes, though. Had she been a cat, she would have had her back arched and her tail like a bottle brush. Rising gracefully to her feet on the layered carpets, she smoothed her dress over her hips.
"Very well, then.
If you're certain you don't want me to stay."
With remarkable timing, a dull throb began behind Egwene's eyes, an all-too-familiar precursor to a blinding headache. But she shook her head anyway and repeated that she had work to do. Halima hesitated a moment longer, her mouth going tight once more, hands fisting in her skirts. Then she snatched her fur-lined silk cloak from the cloak stand and stalked out of the tent without bothering to pull the garment around her shoulders. She could do herself an injury going about like that in the cold. "That fishwife temper will get her in trouble sooner or later," Suan muttered before the entry flap stopped swaying. Scowling after Halima, she twitched her shawl up onto her shoulders. "The woman holds it in around you,
but she doesn't mind giving me the rough side of her tongue. Me or anybody else. She's been heard screaming at Delana. Who ever heard of a secretary screaming at her employer? And a sister at that? A sitter? I don't understand why Delana puts up with her.
That's Delana's business, surely.
Questioning another sister's actions was just as forbidden as interfering with them. Only by custom, not law. Yet some customs were as strong as law. Surely she did not have to remind Suan of that.
Rubbing her temples, Egwene sat down carefully in the chair behind her writing table, but the chair wobbled anyway. Designed to fold for storage on a wagon, the legs had a habit of folding when they were not supposed to, and none of the carpenters had been able to fix them after repeated attempts. The table folded as well, but that held up more firmly. She wished she had taken the opportunity to acquire a new chair in Murundi, yet there had been so many things that needed buying, and not enough coin to stretch when she already had a chair. At least she had acquired a pair of stand lamps and a table lamp, all three plain red-painted iron, but with good mirrors that were free of bubbles. Good light did not seem to help her headaches, yet it was better than trying to read by a few tallow candles and a lantern. If Suan heard any rebuke, it did not slow her down. It's more than just a temper. Once or twice I've thought she was on the brink of trying to strike me. I suppose she has sense enough to hold back from that, but not everyone is Aes Sedai. I'm convinced she managed to break a wheelwright's arm somehow. He says he fell, but he looks to be lying to me, with his eyes shifting and his mouth twitching. He wouldn't like admitting a woman bent his elbow backwards, now would he?
Give over, Suan, Egwene said wearily. The man likely tried to take liberties.
He must have. She could not see how Halima could have broken a man's arm in any event. However you described the woman, muscular did not come into it. Instead of opening the embossed folder that Suan had laid on the table, she rested her hands on either side of it. That kept them away from her head. Maybe if she ignored the pain, it would go away this time. Besides, for a change, she had information to share with Suan.
It seems that some of the sitters are talking about negotiating with Elida, she began.
Expressionless, Suan balanced herself atop one of the two rickety three-legged stools in front of the table and listened attentively, only her fingers moving, lightly stroking against her skirts, until Egwene finished. Then she made fists and growled a set of curses that were pungent even for her, beginning with a wish for the lot of them to choke to death on weak old fish guts and sliding downhill fast from there. Coming from that young, pretty face only made them worse.
I suppose you're right letting it go forward, she muttered, once her invective ran down. The talk will spread now it's begun, and this way you gain a jump on it. Bayonin shouldn't surprise me, I suppose. Bayonin's ambitious, but I always thought she'd have gone scurrying back to Elida if Shiriam and the others hadn't stiffened her backbone.
Voice quickening, Suan fixed her eyes on Egwene as if to lend weight to her words.
I wish Varalyn and that lot surprised me, Mother. Discounting the blue, six sitters from five Ajahs fled the tower after Elida carried out her coup. Her mouth twisted slightly on the word. And here we have one from each of those five. I was in Tel Arun Riod last night in the tower.
I hope you were careful, Egwene said sharply. Suan hardly seemed to know the meaning of careful sometimes. The few dream Turangrial in their possession had lines of sisters panting to use them, mostly to visit the tower. And while Suan was not precisely forbidden one, it was the next thing to. She could have put her name down forever without the hall granting her a single night. Quite aside from the sisters who blamed Suan for the tower being broken in the first place, she was not accepted back quite as warmly as Lyanna on that account, nor cosseted by anyone. Quite aside from that, too many remembered her rough teaching when she was one of the few who knew how to use the dream Turangrial. Suan did not suffer fools gladly, and everyone was a fool their first few times in Tel Arun Riod. So now she had to borrow Lyanna's turn when she wanted to visit the world of dreams, and if another sister saw her there, the next thing, too, might become an outright ban. Or worse,
set off a search for who had loaned her a Turangrial, which might end by unmasking Liana.
"Until I run, Riod," Swan said with a dismissive gesture. "I'm a different woman in a different dress every time I turn a corner."
That was good to hear, though it seemed likely a lack of control had as much to do with it as intent. Swan's belief in her own abilities was sometimes greater than warranted. "The point is, last night I saw a partial list of sitters and managed to read most of the names before it changed to a tally of wines."
That was a common occurrence in Tel Arunriod, where nothing stayed the same for long unless it was a reflection of something permanent in the waking world.
"Andaya Foray was raised for the gray, Rena Hafton for the green, and Jewelaine Madoma for the brown. None has worn the shawl more than 70 years at most. Elida has the same problem we do, Mother."
"I see," Egwene said slowly. She realized that she was massaging the side of her head. The throb behind her eyes beat on. It would grow stronger. It always did. By nightfall, she was going to regret having sent Talima away. Bringing her hand down firmly, she moved the leather folder in front of her a half inch to the left, then slid it back.
What of the rest? They had 6 sitters to replace.
"Farana Neheran was raised for the white," Suan admitted, "and Suana Dragand for the yellow. They've both been in the hall before. It was only a partial list, and I didn't get to read it all."
Her back straightened and her chin shot out stubbornly.
"One or two raised before time would be unusual enough. It happens, but not often. But this makes 11, maybe 12, but 11 for sure, between us and the tower. I don't believe in coincidences that big. When the fishmongers are all buying at the same price, you can bet they were all drinking at the same inn last night."
"You don't have to convince me anymore, Suan." With a sigh, Egwene sat back, automatically catching the chair leg that always tried to fold when she did that. Clearly something odd was happening. But what did it mean? And who could influence the choice of sitters in every Aja? Every Aja except the blue, at least. They had chosen 1 new sitter, but Moria had been Aes Sedai well over 100 years. And maybe the red was not affected. No one knew what changes, if any, had been made in the red sitters. The black might be behind it, but what could they gain, unless all of those 2 young sitters were black? That seemed impossible in any case. If the black Aja had had that much influence, the hall would have been all dark friends long ago. Yet if there was a pattern and coincidence would not hold, then someone had to be at the heart of it. Just thinking about the possibilities, the impossibilities, made the dull pain behind her eyes grow a little sharper. "If this turns out to be happenstance after all, Suan, you're going to regret ever thinking you saw a puzzle." She forced a smile saying that, to take out any sting. And Amarlin had to be careful with her words. "Now that you've convinced me there is a puzzle, I want you to solve it. Who is responsible and what are they after? Until we know that, we don't know anything."
"Is that all you want?" Suan said dryly. "Before supper or after?"
"After we'll have to do, I suppose," Egwene snapped, then took a deep breath at the abashed look on the other woman's face. There was no point taking her headache out on Suan. Anamarlin's words had power and sometimes consequences. She had to remember that. "As soon as you can would be very good, though," she said in a milder voice. "I know you'll be as quick as you can." Chagrined or not, Suan seemed to understand that Egwene's outburst came from more than her own sarcasm. Despite her youthful appearance, she had years of practice at reading faces. "Shall I go find Halima?" she said, half rising. The lack of tartness attached to the woman's name was a measure of her concern. "It won't take a minute." "If I give way for every ache, I'll never get anything done," Egwene said, opening the folder. "Now what do you have for me today?" She kept her hands on the papers, though, to stop from rubbing her head. One of Swan's tasks each morning was to fetch what the Ajahs were willing to share from their networks of eyes and ears, along with whatever individual sisters had passed on to their Ajahs, and the Ajahs had decided to pass on to Egwene. It was a strange process of sieving, yet it still gave a fair picture of the world when added to what Swan put in. She had managed to hold on to the agents that had been hers as Amerlin by the simple expedient of refusing to tell anyone who they were, despite every effort by the Hall. And in the end, no one could gainsay that those eyes and ears were the Amerlin's, and that they should by rights report to Egwene. Oh, there had been no end of grumbling over it, and still was on occasion, but no one could deny the facts. As usual, the first report came from neither the Ajahs nor Swan, but Lyanna, written on thin sheets of paper in a flowing, elegant hand. Egwene could not see exactly why, but you could never doubt that anything Lyanna wrote had been written by a woman. Those pages Egwene held to the table lamp's flame one by one as soon as she read them, letting the paper burn almost to her fingers, then crumpling the ash. It would hardly do for her and Lyanna to behave like near strangers in public, then allow one of her reports to fall into the wrong hands. Very few sisters were aware that Lyanna had eyes and ears inside Tar Valon itself. She might have been the only sister who did. It was a human failing to watch keenly what was happening down the street while ignoring what lay right at your feet, and the light knew Aes Sedai had as many human failings as anyone else. Unfortunately, Lyanna had little new to communicate. Her people in the city complained of filthy streets that were increasingly dangerous after dark and little safer by daylight. Once, crime had been all but unknown in Tar Valon, but now the tower guards had abandoned the streets to patrol the harbors and the bridge towers. Except for collecting the customs duties and buying supplies, both done through intermediaries, the White Tower seemed to have shut itself off from the city completely. The great doors that allowed the public to enter the tower remained shut and barred, and no one had seen a sister outside the tower to know her as Aes Sedai since the siege began, if not earlier. All confirmation of what Lyanna had reported before. The last page made Egwene's eyebrows rise, though. Rumor in the streets said Gareth Bryn had found a secret way into the city, and would appear inside the walls with his whole army any day. Lyanna would have said if anyone had breathed a word that sounded like they meant gateways, Swan said quickly when she saw Egwene's expression. She had read all of these reports already, of course, and knew what Egwene was seeing by which page she held. Shifting on the unsteady stool, Swan almost fell off onto the carpets she was paying so little heed. It did not slow her down a hair, though. "And you can be sure Gareth hasn't let anything slip," she went on while still righting herself. "Not that any of his soldiers are fool enough to desert to the city now, but he knows when to keep his mouth shut. He just has the reputation for attacking where he can't possibly be. He's done the impossible often enough that people expect him to, that's all." Hiding a smile, Egwene held the paper mentioning Lord Gareth to the flame and watched it curl and blacken. A few months passed, Swan would have offered an acid comment about the man instead of praise. He would have been Gareth Bloody Bryn, not Gareth. She could not possibly miss doing his laundry and polishing his boots, but Egwene had seen her staring at him on those rare times when he came to the Aes Sedai camp. Staring and then running away if he so much as glanced at her. Swan! Running away! Swan had been Aes Sedai for more than 20 years and Amerlin for 10, but she had no more idea how to deal with being in love than a duck had about shearing sheep. Egwene crumbled the ash and dusted her hands together, her smile fading. She had no room to talk about Swan. She was in love, too, but she did not even know where in the world Gawain was or what to do if she learned. He had his duty to Andor and she hers to the tower, and the one way to bridge that chasm, bonding him, might lead to his death. Better to let him go, forget him entirely. As easy as forgetting her own name. And she would bond him. She knew that. Of course, she could not bond the man without knowing where he was, without having her hands on him, so it all came full circle. Men were a bother. Pausing to press her fingers against her temples, it did nothing to lessen the pulsing pain. She put Gawain out of her mind.
as far out as she could. She thought she had a foretaste of what it was like having a warder. There was always something of Gawain in the back of her head, and liable to kick its way into her consciousness at the most inconvenient time. Concentrating on the business at hand, she picked up the next sheet. Much of the world had vanished as far as eyes and ears were concerned. Little news came from the lands held by the Seanchan, and that divided between fanciful descriptions of Seanchan beasts delivered as proof they were using shadow spawn, horrifying tales of women being tested to see whether they should be collared as Damani, and depressing stories of acceptance. The Seanchan, it seemed, were no worse rulers than any others, and better than some, as long as you were not a woman who could channel, and all too many people appeared to have given up thoughts of resistance once it became clear the Seanchan would let them go on with their lives. Arad Domon was almost as bad, producing nothing but rumors, admitted as such by the sisters who wrote the reports, but included just to show the state the country was in. King Al-Salam was dead. No, he had begun channeling and gone mad. Rodal Iteralda, the great captain, also was dead, or he had usurped the throne, or was invading Saldaya. The Council of Merchants were all dead as well, or had fled the country, or begun a civil war over who the next king was to be. Any of those might have been true, or none. The Ajahs were accustomed to seeing everything, but now a third of the world had been enveloped in dense fog, with only the tiniest gaps. At least, if there were any clearer views, no Aja had deigned to pass on what they saw there. Another problem was that the Ajahs saw different things as having paramount importance and largely ignored anything else. The Greens, for example, were particularly concerned over tales of borderland armies near New Braem, hundreds of leagues from the blight they were supposed to be guarding. Their report talked of the borderlanders, and only the borderlanders, as if something had to be done and done now. Not that they suggested anything or so much as hinted, yet frustrations came through in the cramped, hasty handwriting that spidered urgently across the page. Egwene had the truth of that situation from Elaine, but she was content to let the Greens gnash their teeth for the moment, since Suan had revealed why they were not rushing off to set matters straight. According to her agent in New Braem, the Borderlanders were accompanied by 50 or 100 sisters, perhaps 200. The number of Aes Sedai might be uncertain, and it must be wildly inflated, of course, but their presence was a fact the Greens had to be aware of, though the reports they sent to Egwene never mentioned them. No Aja had mentioned those sisters in their reports. In the end, though, there was little difference between 200 sisters and 2. No one could be certain who those sisters were or why they were there, yet poking a nose in would surely be seen as interfering. It seemed strange that they could be engaged in a war between Aes Sedai and still be held back from interfering with another sister by custom, but thankfully it was so. "At least they don't suggest sending anyone to Camelin," Egwene blinked, the pain behind her eyes sharpened by following the tight letters. Suan gave a derisive snort. "Why should they? As far as they know, Elaine is letting Marilla and Van Deen guide her, so they're sure they'll get their Aes Sedai queen, and a green at that. Besides, as long as the Ashamans stay out of Camelin, no one wants to take the chance of stirring them up. The way things stand, we might as well try pulling wasp jellies out of the water with our bare hands, and even the Greens know it. Anyway, that won't stop some sister, green or otherwise, from dropping into Camelin. Just a quiet visit to see one of her eyes and ears, or to have a dress made, or buy a saddle, or the light knows why else." "Even the Greens?" Egwene said tartly. Everyone thought of Browns being this way and Whites that, even when it was demonstrably not so. Yet sometimes she bristled a little at hearing Greens lumped together as if they were all the same woman. Maybe she did think of herself as a Green, or as having been one, which was silly. The Amarlin was of all Ajahs and none. She adjusted the stole on her shoulders, reminding herself of the fact represented by those 7 stripes, and she had never belonged to one in the first place. Yet she did feel a... not fondness, that was too strong. a sense of sameness between herself and Green sisters. How many sisters are unaccounted for, Suan? Even the weakest can travel wherever they want, linked. And I wish I knew where they went. For a moment, Suan frowned in thought. About 20, I think, she said finally. Maybe a few less. The number changes day to day. No one keeps track, really. No sister would stand still for it. She leaned forward, carefully balancing herself this time when the uneven legs made her stool lurch. You've juggled matters beautifully so far, Mother, but it can't last. Eventually, the Hall will find out everything that's going on in Camelin. They might accept keeping the Shanshan prisoners secret. That will be seen as Van Deen's business or Marilla's, but they already know there are sea folk in Camelin, and they'll learn about the bargain with them sooner or later. And the kin, if not your plans for them. Suan snorted again, though faintly. She was not certain how she herself felt about the idea of Aes Sedai retiring into the kin, much less how other sisters would take to the notion. My eyes and ears haven't picked up a glimmer yet, but somebody's will, as sure as certain. You can't delay much longer, or we'll find ourselves wading through a school of silverpike. One of these days, Egwene muttered, I'll have to see these silverpike you're always talking about. She held up a hand as the other woman opened her mouth. One day. The agreement with the sea folk will cause problems, she confessed. But when the Ajahs hear hints, they won't realize right away what they're hearing. Sisters teaching sea folk in Camelin? It's unheard of, but who is going to ask questions or interfere against all custom? I'm sure there will be all sorts of grumbling, maybe some questions called in the hall, but before it comes out that there is a bargain, I will have introduced my plan for the kin. You think that won't sharpen their teeth? Shifting her shawl, Suan barely bothered to hide her incredulity. In fact, she scowled with it. It will cause argument, Egwene allowed judiciously. A considerable understatement. It would cause an uproar, was what it would do once the whole was known. Likely as close to a riot as had ever been seen among Aes Sedai. But the tower had been dwindling for 1,000 years now, if not more, and she planned to put an end to that. But I do intend to go slowly. Aes Sedai may be reluctant to talk about age, Suan, but they'll figure out soon enough that swearing on the oath rod shortens our lives by half at least. No one wants to die before they must. If they're convinced there really is a kinswoman who's 600 years old, Suan said in grudging tones, and Egwene sighed with vexation. That was another thing the other woman was uncertain about, the kin's claims of longevity. She valued Suan's advice, valued that she did not just say what Egwene wanted to hear, but at times the woman seemed to drag her heels as hard as Romanda or Lelaine. If need be, Suan, she said irritably, I'll just let the sisters talk to a few women 100 years or more older than any of them. They may try to dismiss them as wilders and liars, but Rihanna Corley can prove she was in the tower and when. So can others. With luck, I'll convince the sisters to accept being freed of the 3 oaths so they can retire into the kin before they ever learn there's a bargain with the Atha An Mier. And once they accept any sister being freed of the oaths, it won't be nearly as hard to convince them to let the sea folk sisters go. Beside that, the rest of that agreement is small turnips. As you keep saying, skill and a deft hand are necessary to get anything done in the hall, but luck is absolutely required. Well, I'll be as skillful and deft as I can be, and as for luck, the odds seem to be in my favor for once. Suan grimaced and hemmed and hawed, but she had to agree in the end. She even agreed that Egwene might pull it off, with luck and timing. Not that she was convinced about the kin or the agreement with the Atha An Mier, either one, but what Egwene proposed was so unprecedented that it seemed the greater part of it might pass the hall before they realized what was falling on them. Egwene was willing to settle for that. Whatever was laid before the hall, almost always enough sitters stood in opposition to make finding a consensus hard work at best, and nothing was done in the hall without at least the lesser consensus, and usually not without the greater. It seemed to her that most dealings with the hall consisted of convincing them to do what they did not want to,
There was certainly no reason for this to be any different. While the Greens concentrated on the Borderlanders, the Greys focused south at present. Every Aja was fascinated by the reports from Ilion and Tyr of large numbers of wilders among the sea folk, which they found interesting if true, though there seemed strong doubt that it could be true, or else sisters would have known about it before this. After all, how could such a thing be hidden? No one mentioned that they had just accepted what they saw on the surface and never looked deeper. The Greys, though, were fascinated by the continued Seanchan threat to Ilion and the recently begun siege of the Stone of Tyr. Wars and threats of war always mesmerized Greys, since they were dedicated to ending strife, and to extending their influence, of course. Every time the Greys stopped a war with a treaty, they increased the influence of all Aes Sedai, but of Greys most of all. The Seanchan seemed beyond negotiation, however, at least by Aes Sedai, and the Greys' outraged sense of being thwarted came through in curt words about Seanchan incursions across the border, and the increasing forces being gathered by Lord Gregorin, the steward in Ilion for the Dragon Reborn, a title that was a matter of some concern in itself. Tyr had its own steward for the Dragon Reborn, the High Lord Darlin Cisnera, and he was besieged in the stone by nobles who refused to accept Rand. It was a very strange siege. The stone had its own docks, and Darlin's enemies could not cut off supplies, even holding the rest of the city as they did, and they seemed content to sit and wait in any event. Or perhaps they just could not see what to do next. Only the Aiel had ever taken the stone by assault, and no one had ever starved it out. The Greys had some hopes in Tyr. Egwene's head came up as she read to the bottom of the page, and she hurriedly set that page down and picked up the next. The Greys had had some hopes. Apparently a Grey sister had been recognized coming out of the stone and followed to a meeting with High Lord Tadosian and High Lady Estunda, two of the most prominent among the besiegers. "Mirana," she breathed. "They say it was Mirana Ambry, Swan." Unconsciously, she massaged her temple. The pain behind her eyes had ratcheted a little higher. "She may do some good." Rising, Suan crossed the carpets to a small table against the tent wall, where several mismatched cups and two pitchers sat on a tray. The silver pitcher held spiced wine and blue-glazed pottery tea, both set there at first light against the Amerlin's arrival, and both long since gone cold. No one had expected Egwene to go riding off to the river. "As long as Tadosian and the others don't realize who she's really working for." Swan's shawl slipped off one shoulder as she felt the side of the pottery pitcher, and the light of Sidar surrounded her briefly as she channeled fire, warming the contents. "They won't trust her to negotiate in good faith if they find out she's the Dragon Reborn's creature." Filling a polished pewter cup with tea, she added generous dollops from the honey jar, stirring it in well, and brought the cup back to Egwene. "This might help your head. It's some sort of herb concoction Chesa found, but honey cuts the taste." Egwene took a cautious sip and set the cup down with a shudder. If it tasted that sharp with honey, she did not want to imagine it without. The headache might be better. "How can you take this so calmly, Suan? Mirana turning up in Tyr is the first real proof we've had. I'll take your sitters as coincidence before that." In the beginning, there had only been whispers, from the Ajahs or from Suan's eyes and ears. There were Aes Sedai in Cairhien, and they seemed to move freely in and out of the Sun Palace while the Dragon Reborn was there. Then the whispers grew hoarse and uneasy, hesitant. The eyes and ears in Cairhien did not want to say it. No one wanted to repeat what their agents said. There were Aes Sedai in Cairhien, and they seemed to be following the orders of the Dragon Reborn. Worse were the names that trickled out. Some were women who had been in Salidar, among the first to resist Elida, while others were women known to be loyal to Elida. No one had mentioned compulsion aloud that Egwene knew of, but they had to be thinking it. "No use pulling your hair when the wind isn't blowing the way you want," Swan replied, taking her stool again.
She started to cross her knees, but hastily put both feet back on the carpet when her stool tilted. Muttering under her breath, she adjusted her shawl with a twitch of her shoulders, and was forced to balance against another lurch.
"You have to trim your sails to take advantage of how the wind is blowing. Think coolly, and you'll make it back to shore. Get your neck hot, and you'll drown."
Sometimes Swan could sound as if she still worked a fishing boat.
"I believe you need more than one sip for that to do any good, Mother."
With a grimace, Egwene pushed the cup a little farther from her. The taste clinging to her tongue was at least as bad as her headache.
"Swan, if you see a way to make use of this, I wish you'd tell me. I don't even want to think about using the fact that Rand may have compelled sisters. I don't want to think about the possibility that he could have."
Neither about the possibility that he knew such a repulsive weave, or that he could lay that weave on anyone. She knew it, another little gift from Mogadin, and she very much wished she could forget how to make it.
"In this case, it isn't so much a matter of using as figuring out the effects. He'll have to be dealt with eventually and maybe taught a lesson, but you don't want sisters flying off after him now, and these tales out of Kyrian make everyone cautious."
Suan's voice was calm enough, but she fidgeted, clearly agitated inwardly. It was nothing any Aes Sedai could speak of too calmly.
"At the same time, once everyone thinks it through, they'll realize this makes nonsense out of those stories about him submitting to Elida. She might have sent sisters to watch over him, but they wouldn't accept sisters who want to pull Elida down. Realizing that will put a little backbone in those who've started thinking maybe Elida has him on a lead. That's one less reason for anyone to consider yielding to her."
"What about Cadswain?" Egwene said. Of all the names coming out of Kyrian, that one had sent the most shock through the sisters. Cadswain Maladrin was a legend, and there were as many disapproving versions of the legend as approving. Some sisters had been sure it must be a mistake. Cadswain must be dead by now. Others just appeared to wish she were dead.
"Are you certain she remained in Kyrian after Rand disappeared?"
"I made sure my people kept an eye on her as soon as I heard her name," Swan said, no longer sounding at all calm. "I don't know she's a dark friend, I just suspect. But I can guarantee that she was in the Sun Palace a week after he vanished."
Squeezing her eyes shut, Egwene pressed the heels of her palms against her lids. That hardly seemed to affect the pulsing needle in her head.
"Maybe Rand was in company with a black sister, or had been. Maybe he had used compulsion on Aes Sedai. Bad enough on anyone, but somehow worse used on Aes Sedai, more ominous. What was dared against Aes Sedai was 10 times, 100 times as likely to be used against those who could not defend themselves. Eventually they would have to deal with him somehow. She had grown up with Rand, yet she could not allow that to influence her. He was the dragon reborn now, the hope of the world, and at the same time maybe the single greatest threat the world faced. Maybe. The Shan Shan could not do as much damage as the dragon reborn, and she was going to use the possibility that he had compelled sisters. The Ammerlin seat really was a different woman from that innkeeper's daughter." Scowling at the pewter cup of so-called tea, she picked it up and made herself drink the vile stuff down, gagging and spluttering the whole way. Perhaps the taste would take her mind off her headache, at least. As she set the cup down with a sharp clink of metal on wood, Anaya pushed into the tent, mouth turned down, and a frown creasing her plain face.
"Akarin and the others have returned, Mother," she said. "Moria told me to inform you she has called the hall to hear their report."
"So have Esmeralda and Malind," Morvryn announced, coming in behind Anaya with Mirel. The green seemed an image of serene fury, if that was possible, her olive face smooth and her eyes like dark embers, but Morvryn wore a scowl to make Anaya look pleased.
"They're sending novices and accepted running to find all the sitters," the brown said. "We can't catch a whisper of what Akarin found, but I think Esmeralda and the others intend to use it to prod the hall towards something."
Peering at the dark dregs floating in a few drops in the bottom of the pewter cup, Egwene sighed. She would have to be there too,
and now she would have to face the sitters with a headache and that awful taste in her mouth. Perhaps she could call it a penance for what she was going to do to the hall.